All right, can you lighten up a little bit? We got a party to attend.
Hey, whoa, good person. How about you put a tie on, okay? It's a cocktail party, not a Quiznos opening.
What? I haven't worn a tie since my mother's funeral when I was 3. I'm not gonna start that up again.
That's great. Put on a tie.
No!
Put on a tie.
I'll never sell out!
I'll give you $100.
Hey, where's the tie?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's month's Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I am here with my partner, Devin. We're here today to discuss the Susan Sarandon James Caan classic, That's My Boy. And I have to say that I'm a little hot under the collar for this one, Devin. I don't know if I'm prepared to really dive, as it were, to the bottom of the proverbial barrel.
I'm right there with you, Sijin. I'm quite excited to explore this film, but I am quite aware that it will require the strongest and heaviest weights in my entire bathysphere to get down to the depths that this film plumes. And that's what's up. Welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. As Sijin said, we're your curators. I'm Devin Decker. He's Sijin Sarawick. You probably know us from the Say Report, or maybe you just listen to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Either way, welcome to March 2020's episode. It's episode 3 of season 3, and the theme of season 3 is villains.
Yeah, we fucked up, Dev. We made a big old mistake.
That's a bold statement that I don't think
This
I
should have been
disagree
the
with.
first and only movie we did this season.
No, it shouldn't have been. I understand why that would be the conclusion you could come to. I think it'd be an easy conclusion for anyone to come to that film, to after watching this film. But the fact of the matter is, this movie is really only a villain because of the public perception of this film. And the fact that a major plot point, nay, the first 15 minutes of this film, is about a teacher taking advantage of a 13-year-old boy.
I mean, yes, the major plot of this film revolves around child molestation. Yes. I don't think there's no ifs, ands, or buts about this public perception by my ass. Like, this movie is
Well,
the
no, but
only
it.
thing crazier than this movie's plot is the fact that, like, it was allowed to come out.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. But I guess the reason why I consider this film a villain, because let me tell you, I have some hot takes on this film. This movie, more than any other Adam Sandler film that we've watched so far for this series, and this is number 16 that we've done so far for the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, this film got under my skin and into my mind in ways that I'm not sure I'm ready to talk about.
Yeah,
But we
no.
have a deadline, so
Yeah.
that's wh so we're recording,
Yeah, I
and
mean, and that deadline is March 31st, apparently.
and I yeah, well, that's the other thing. So the most important thing before we talk any more about That's My Boy is, if you do not own this film, if you have never seen this film, but you happen to have a subscription to Netflix, not a sponsor, it is available on Netflix through March 31st. And if you've never seen this movie, and believe me, I wouldn't be surprised if you had never seen this movie, full confession, everything on the table, this is the first time that either Sijin or I ever saw this film was for the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. If you've never seen it, I implore you right now to stop this recording and go watch the movie.
I don't know if I can, in good conscience, endorse that, but sure,
I mean,
yeah,
the
you
re
have the ability to do so. I will get behind that thought.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where, honestly, if you do not watch that movie, it's going to sound like we're speaking Sanskrit, which
Yeah,
is really
that's
impressive
true.
because that's a written language. You need the Rosetta Stone that is That's My Boy, and it is available, it is on display in the Netflix Museum until it moves, I don't know, probably to Amazon Prime, possibly to HBO Max. I'm sure it will still be available afterwards, but it is currently March 2022, and through March 31st, 2022, it is available on Netflix. And it is a film that if you're truly going to understand what we're about to talk about, you kind of need to watch.
I mean, yeah, if you want to understand anything that's about to happen over the next couple of hours here, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. You need to see the movie to believe this movie for sure. I just, my feelings going into this movie are obviously pretty clear by now. But the reason that I say that this should have been the first and only movie in the villain season is because this truly is a villainous film for so many reasons, not least of which this movie feels like that kid at school that everybody calls like the bully and the troublemaker, and they finally snap and they just become the bully because that's what everybody has called them. like it is the childish reaction of, fine, you're gonna accuse me of it, then I'm gonna do it. And that is this movie to Adam Sandler's career.
I am so glad.
All of the stuff that people think of when they think of Adam Sandler movies, where they're just like, oh, they're just like gross out like comedies and like dick and fart jokes and all that sort of stuff. And it's like, yeah, but not on the level at which we all talk about it, right? No, this movie is the level at which we talk about those. If this was one of his earliest movies in his career, there'd be no career. Right, but there'd be good reason for my parents to be like, no, you're never watching an Adam Sandler movie again.
Yeah, I'm super happy that first impression-wise, we're on the same page.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because we've become scholars of Adam Sandler over the last year or like 15 months, but it truly is. This film feels so much like, oh, you think that's all my movies are? Well, fuck you. Here's what that would look like.
Yeah. It is upsetting to watch as somebody that would like to see more in like the Happy Gilmore, Billy Madison vein from Sandler. And this almost feels like a kind of return to form in that way, like character work going on and all sorts of stuff that we'll get into. But the idea being that like it is everything that people seem to think the rest of his movies are. I almost wonder if this is it. Is this the movie that kind of gives everybody the ability to bounce out, right? To say like, yeah, see, Adam Sandler, this is just the kind of movies he makes, and I'm just not going to do that anymore. And so he needs to find himself a new home, because it is only a couple of years after this that he ends up in the Netflix deal, right?
It is a year after this that he truly winds up at Netflix. Cobbler is 2013, and the Cobbler is his first one with Netflix. And it is a long relationship that it's touching on 10 years. Because also, this is the 10-year anniversary of That's My Boy, which is also all sorts of insane when you consider how much progress we have made as a people in 10 years. In the fact that, like, I don't think a movie like That's My Boy could get made in 2022.
Oh, no way. There's no way this movie would. No, it would. It might sneak its way onto something like a Netflix, like, right. and then it would be rightly torn to shreds, right? Because just as we pointed out, the first 15 minutes of this movie is like, it revels in this plot line that it is all about how this high school boy.
He's
right?
A middle school student.
Middle school boy.
He is 13. We watch his bar mitzvah.
Right. This middle school boy has a relationship with a teacher that then leads to this pregnancy of which we have the child, which is just like, oh man, I could not help but wonder the entire time that we're watching that first bit and thinking like, man, is there any way that they could have like implied all of this and not had to just sit in it for 15 minutes? Would that have helped? Would that have made it better? And no, it wouldn't have made it better. At the end of the day, the situation is the situation. It's just the fact that it makes you just live in it for so long. And it doesn't seem to call it out until it does. But by that point, it's too late. It has been way too celebratory up to that point. I mean, like, it's the South Park bit, right? Like, yeah. the whole boy sleeps with an older female teacher and everybody's just like, nice. And that goes on for far too long before one sensible person in this movie is just like, you're all friggin' psychopaths.
Yeah, but also that one sensible person in this film is the only sensible person in this film, which is another thing that we're going to talk about as we get deeper into our exploration of That's My Boy.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of the cornerstone of my decision regarding its status within the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Okay.
And that's the important thing, right? That's what we're here to do. Because the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, what CJ and I are here to do is to watch these Adam Sandler films and to determine our own personal shared cinematic universe of Adam Sandler films. It came about because of Hubie Halloween. We tell the story all the time. But after Hubie Halloween, with Ben Stiller showing back up, everybody was like, oh my God, do all of the movies exist together?
Yeah, I don't know why it took Ben Stiller of everybody.
Of all
that
things.
Always
yeah.
shows up in all of his movies, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, and if you listen to the other episodes, we have counted out and we have cut off a lot of moments that would definitely point to a shared cinematic universe. But
still
we
haven't figured out how he got Steve Buscemi to be in that one, though.
No, no. Actually, you know what really bothers me? I don't know how Boardwalk Empire got Steve Buscemi to be get the guy after being in all the Adam Sandler films. That don't make sense to me. How's he playing Nookie? How's he playing Nookie? But yeah, so that's what we're here to do. We're here to watch all the Adam Sandler movies that are available and that will eventually come out and determine where they fit into our own personal shared cinematic universe of Adam Sandler films. And the third season, we're looking at the villainous films. And as Seijin said, this one could kind of be the only one and then we move on. But it's kind of more than that. Like with Spanglish, we looked at it because the public perception of that movie is fuck that movie. I was lied to by the marketing. Whereas with something like That's My Boy, the public perception is fuck that movie. I can't believe they reveled for 15 minutes in the fact that an older female teacher took advantage of a young middle school age child.
Yeah, that like a sex crime is celebrated as the front and center plot point of the film.
Yeah, and it's really it goes even one step further because I had a lot of difficulty coming to grips with the fact that this film opens in 1984 because it doesn't feel like the kind of thing that was discussed in 1984. Like just flat out, not a thing that people were really worried about. So
no.
I went through.
Actually, the opposite. Before you do what you're about to do, We should point out that what's really going on in 1984 is you have hit songs like Hot for Teacher. Like the idea of the rock and roll idea of like inappropriate age gaps in relationships is hot and heavy. We are now learning like all sorts of gross shit about like guys that would go on tour with like 13-year-old groupies and stuff, right? And meanwhile, they were singing songs about it. Nobody was just paying attention, I guess. I don't know. So like the 80s is like living in this shit. But sorry, because what happens in 1990?
Well, 1990 is the first time that one of these inappropriate relationships really comes to a head. And really the only reason that it comes to any sort of head is that the teacher who seduced four freshman age students had seduced them so that they would murder her husband. And she ends up charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. And this is such a popular thing, that this is such a thing in the news, that in 1995, there is a Nicole Kidman-led film called To Die For that is based on it. And really, that's the first time that any of this sort of came around and came along. And it's ingrained in people's memory because I spoke to my parents about it. And my mother was like, there's that Nicole Kidman picture that's about it. And that had to have come out in like the 90s. And of course, I was prepared with all of the information about it. But and that's the thing. And really,
some might say overprepared.
Yeah. To have a discussion with my mother about this specific topic. But then what this movie is cribbing from, what this script by David Caspi is totally cribbing from, is the Mary Kay Letourneau situation. Because in 1997, she slept with a student. She was eventually charged with two charges of second degree statutory rape. Which the levels of statutory rape is an insane Wikipedia page if you're just like can't fall asleep, because trust me, sleep will feel like a welcome escape if you start down that page. So it's 1997, and that student ends up getting her pregnant. Like, it is literally, the plot of That's My Boy would be a Law & Order ripped from the headlines based on the Mary Kay Letourneau story. Like, even down to the fact that that student was still in love with her, and after she got out of jail, they got married and settled down. And it wasn't until 2018 that he realized how manipulative and wrong that relationship was.
Yeah, and as I pointed out, there's a lot of pop culture kind of in and out about this conversation, right? Sometimes it's most of the time it is a young female and an older male, and then that's always reprimanded. I mean, as you pointed out, like Law and Order, I mean, like, you could probably find more than
there's
one
a bunch
episode,
of episodes
right?
about it. Yeah,
right. I mean, Boston Public are, like, I think addressed an inappropriate relationship at some point. Like, there's all sorts of that. But then, as is then rightly pointed out later, is the idea that the male to female swap in that situation is often not frowned upon, but still celebrated, right? It's still, for some reason, that seems to, and so it gets called out. And so there's this weird part of me that wants to try and think that maybe that's what they're attempting to do in this movie. But as we've talked about with other Sandler movies in the past, that whenever he touches anything that is even remotely a political stance, even if it's something as simple as, hey, teachers shouldn't sleep with young children, like this idea being that he doesn't, the movie, I shouldn't lay this all at Sandler's feet, the movie does not take a stand against it in any meaningful way. I would be remiss if I did not, you know, point out that there is definitely moments where there is like a clear-headed response to that. You point out that she's the only reasonable, the judge in the first 15 minutes that does, you know, sentence the teacher to prison and you know, make sure that the kid has a home and all this sort of stuff is great. And she points out what a horrible thing this all is. And then, like, later on in the movie, there is definitely these elements of, like, shame and this understanding that, like, that was a terrible situation with both Todd, the child that comes out of this, as well as some other characters in the movie. But the problem is that at that point, it's all buried in under so much other ridiculousness and even weirder shit at the end of this movie that this movie just doesn't ever tell you that this is bad.
Right.
Even when it uses the words, it doesn't feel like it means it.
Well, and really, the craziest thing is, this is a film that has those heartfelt moments, but unlike something like Chuck and Larry, our other villain film so far for season 3, it doesn't lean into it enough. Chuck and Larry, it feels like tonal whiplash when it goes from like heavy Asian stereotype jokes with Rob Schneider to like a moment where they're talking about what love is and what partnership is and what it means to be there for somebody, to the fact that you're just like, oh my God, am I watching the same movie?
Yeah.
That's My Boy. It succeeds in the fact that it always feels like one complete package. Everything is homogenized. Unfortunately, it is homogenized to the lowest common denominator. And that really does a disservice to those moments that would actually be meaningful.
And the other side of that is that this is not the complication of the film. Like, I think that's the big thing that really kind of throws me is as you pointed out, this was my first time seeing it, your first time seeing it for the show, right? And I didn't really understand how inconsequential it really ends up being. Like, it's a huge part of Donnie's personality and it's a huge part of Todd's background. So, like, it being there is important. But at the end of the day, the heartfelt moments that you're talking about aren't about Donnie learning that he was sexually assaulted as a child. It is about how he doesn't have a great relationship with his kid. At the end of the day, it's just a father-son story. It has nothing to do with this whole idea that his whole oeuvre is because he got really, like, he got into a terrible situation with his kid, and basically the rest of his life is him not dealing with trauma. like it is crazy how much it is always present and never dealt with. Like, that's the crazy thing is Chuck and Larry, as much as you can say there was tonal whiplash and it felt like it didn't feel like a complete piece, at least it was addressing its issue. At least you could say that the theme was there. It's crazy how much it really doesn't matter in some of these heartfelt moments, the actual background. all you need to know is that he's just a dad that loves his son and they don't connect really well is really the only emotional piece you need to understand those moments.
Well, I mean, there's the secondary thing, but we'll jump into that after the synopsis, where I explain some a bit more nuance of what's going on in this film. I just use nuance to describe "That's My Boy," right?
Yeah.
If there are podcast awards, that was me looking for the fucking Oscar. just being straight with you, because oh my god, nuance and "That's My Boy."
We want a Casty.
The Casties. Yeah, we want a Casty. They probably call them the Steves or something like that. They might even be the Rogans because we didn't know. We didn't understand at the time. But we'll get there. And before we get there, I think that we've both elaborated on our first opinions of this film, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have any facts and figures that we can throw at the people so that they can like truly understand why this film is a villain, not just in the public perception of its plot line, but also
I'm just trying to see where it lands in Sandler's whole thing so that I don't misspeak there, That's My Boy is what he does the same year as Hotel Transylvania, funny enough. As we've mentioned in the past, he gets into doing the 2-movie to 3-movie a year kind of thing at this point, and the only thing that follows up after this is Grown Ups 2. Like that in terms of like where he is in his career, right? So like that's kind of Sandler's whole thing. As far as the rest of the world goes, this is 2012, right? We're kind of at the end and slowly moving away from some of the meaner comedy, and I feel like this movie is late to the party in a lot of ways. Like a lot of the stuff that you see in this movie, like the not just mean comedy but like gross out mean comedy, mm-hmm. because like there's a lot of stuff going on here that you could look back and see definitely being inspired by like Wedding Crashers and was Hangover up before?
Hangover's 2009
so like that kind of R-rated comedy. That's the other thing to keep in mind is this is an R-rated film. I don't know how many of those we've hit so far in our series.
This might be the first one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is the first one that we're actually covering.
Yeah. Yeah. And so from that, like, that's kind of where, like, Sandler is and where we are. The weird part for me is that I cannot believe this. It comes out June 15th, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it comes out alongside only one other movie at that time, Rock of Ages, of all movies.
Oh, God, what a terrible movie. Also featuring, you know, statutory rape because it's music in the 80s. Also, that's funny that it comes out the same day as Rock of Ages and literally opens with Rock of Ages by Led Zeppelin.
Yes.
Unterglieber Gauten Globen.
So the thing that really threw me is before this and Rock of Ages come out on this date, it has been 8 weeks since a major release. The major release 8 weeks previously are Madagascar 3 and Prometheus, and they're still up there, right? But this is the same year of, like, Moonrise Kingdom. This is the same year of Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. But those have been out for months at this point.
What about Avengers?
Avengers has been out for according to Box Office Mojo, 43 weeks. So do the math on that. 10 months. So it's almost a year at this point. So like
that doesn't make any sense. Avengers was a 2012 movie. How was it out for 43 weeks in June when it released in May?
Oh, 43 days.
43 days. Okay, so the major release before this is Avengers.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, Prometheus is a pretty big one. Like,
I thought Prometheus was before this. Was I wrong on that? 43 days seems like very short time between the two.
Yeah, but
Sorry, I'm going to call
you. No, so there is a good few like there's at least a week and a half between like major releases, and really more than that, because as you're pointing out, with Avengers really being like the $1 billion movie, because everything else is in that 100 million to 150 million range by the time it's done. Hunger Games has been out for a few months as well, but that is not Avengers level as we now know, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this idea that it just shits out at some point in the middle of June, like in the middle of the summer, like between major releases, right? So like this idea that it kind of, I don't know if they, I'm trying to figure out if people got out of the way because an Adam Sandler movie was coming out, Right? Like, that's the question. Is 2012 a little too late in his career, right after, like, right when he's on the cusp of, like, Hotel Transylvania and Grown Ups and all that stuff? Is he the box office, not just a box office draw, but also, like, do you avoid him? Do you not want to go up against him? Or is this just that time of the year, just another one of those weird times of the year where, like, hey, nobody's doing anything. Like, let's push something out.
2012 was a very strange year for movies, and I'm purely basing that off of personal empirical evidence. So much so to the fact that in 2012, I only saw 14 new movies in the theater. I only went out to the theater 14 times.
Just to like comedy wise, like this is also the same year as Three Stooges, the
Yeah, like
weird
it is.
Farley Brothers Three Stooges. Yeah.
There was something going on in 2012 where, like, we had just all of the big, like, everybody knew Avengers was coming. So it really feels like everybody was like, ah, we're kind of going to just give it a wide berth, right? We'll put together things that, like, could fill the void if Avengers ends up falling on its face. But it honestly feels like Avengers had such a large effect on what people were willing to put in the box office for 2012. In addition to that, all of the movies that I saw were pretty much pre-Avengers. Like, I can think of going to the movies and seeing two, three films a week up until Avengers came out. And then the last thing for 2012 is you have the shooting in Aurora, Colorado during The Dark Knight Rises, which also completely changed how people approached going to the movie theater. It's undeniable to talk about. So this film is pre that moment where we were kind of afraid to go to the movies, right? But it is post Avengers. That's My Boy comes out in honestly the weirdest moment in cinematic history pre the COVID-19 pandemic.
I mean, at least since 2001, right? At least since 9/11. Like, this is it's kind of a weird threshold. Well, and like we've talked on the Sega Report before about the idea that I stand firm in the idea that decades don't end at the tens, right? Like they really don't get their steam going until about for the 80s it wouldn't have been until about 82, 83, and then you saw the 80s kind of doing its thing until about 91, and then like going and then we hit the 90s. So when you're in 2012, you're kind of right on that cusp of getting into what might be like what the teens are. This is the make it or break it year. This is what's going to define what the next decade's going to be. So if That's My Boy hits, then like the R-rated gross out comedy, but led by like bigwig stars like Sandler are going to be the next big thing, right? Like, because we were doing the kind of gross out comedy, but what it was doing was it was kind of revamping a lot of people's careers as opposed to like or starting some. I mean, like you think about Zach Galifianakis before The Hangover, right? Like, I mean, he definitely was doing work, but not
But
like he
not to
was
the
after
level he
that.
was doing afterwards. Melissa McCarthy, something like Bridesmaids, and how that completely changed the face of comedy. I mean, 2012 is this crazy year, and for this to be one of those films that comes out basically unopposed, it is really just indicative of what we were doing in 2012.
This is also that really weird year where we movie doubles always happen, but this is the weird year of Snow White and the Huntsman and Mirror Mirror coming out almost like a week apart from each other.
I've only ever seen one of those. Guess which one?
I hope it's Snow White and the Huntsman
Oh, it's
because
Snow White
then
and
the
the
sequel
Huntsman.
is.
Oh, the sequel is one of the greatest movies ever made. This is Say Report Talk, so if you're interested, come find us on the Say Report.
But yeah, so that's what's going on kind of in the world at this time.
And how does it perform? Does this movie at least make its money back for being as incendiary as it is?
So it is a $70 million budget for this movie, and I mean that's pretty understandable when you look at some of the people that are in it. Not least of all because we also haven't really mentioned, and maybe we'll talk about this more after your synopsis. But this is a dual hander. It's not just an Adam Sandler movie. This is an Andy Samberg film as well, right? And I'm not saying that he was huge big budget money at that time like he would be now, but he was definitely starting this trajectory that we now see him on, right? So getting both him in there and Sandler could not have been cheap on their own, right? And then you have everything else that goes on in this movie. I mean, the beach house alone is probably $10 million of the budget. but worth its money. So $70 million to make this movie, right? I will give you give me a percentage on what you think it makes back just domestically.
51.23%. Beep boop boop beep.
I don't think no. It's the answer to that. No, actually, that is pretty close. Actually, now that I'm looking at it, so it makes 64% is the actual number, but in millions, so 70 million, it only makes about
Yeah, it makes
$36 million.
about half of its budget back, right?
Internationally, it does score another 20 million.
That's impressive.
Except that only adds to 50 million. It
Yeah.
never makes its money back. It is an abject failure on that front.
And that's an important thing to understand, especially when I've never fully grasped why people were so anti-Pixels when Pixels came out,
Which
because
is a couple of years after this,
it's
right?
2 years after this film, and it's the first live-action Adam Sandler film being released to movie theaters post That's My Boy. And I never fully grasped until I saw That's My Boy,
Yeah.
is what I'm gonna say.
And just to, you're not the only one that was kind of we're not the only ones that feeling this way, right? So it just to give some hot numbers really quick, Rotten Tomatoes, 20% from critics alone. And then audiences, and this is something true kind of across the board, audiences are at 50%. There seems to be a lot of people out there that don't seem to mind this movie, and there seems to be a lot of people out there that friggin' hate this movie. There doesn't seem to be a consensus on this film anywhere you look. The weirdest one is Amazon. If you go to Amazon, somehow it's got a 4 point some odd ratings, but that has to be because the only people bothering to look at That's My Boy anymore are just the people that like it, right? Anybody that didn't like this movie just has stopped thinking about it since they saw it.
Or the fact that you can buy the 4K HDR version for $1 less than the regular version has really sold people on the value of That's My Boy.
Movie sucks, but man, it looks so good.
Look how good it is. Look at it. Look at James Caan.
Look at Dan Patrick in that wig.
Oh, Dan Patrick. Yeah,
It's the
yeah.
biggest Dan Patrick role yet. We'll
It.
get to it. We'll
Well,
get to
we'll
it.
get there. Don't worry. We got a lot to talk about. I think it's synopsis time, though. Does it feel like synopsis time to you?
Yeah, please, please give me that
Okay.
synopsis. Let me remind me about all of the ins and outs of this film, please.
All right. In 1984, 13-year-old Donnie Berger got to live out every young man's dream, engaging in a sexual relationship with his math teacher, Miss Mary Beth McGarrickle. Eventually, their tryst is exposed, and Miss McGarrickle is sentenced to 30 years in prison. To complicate the matter, even though it brought them joy, their sexual congress resulted in a pregnancy, and the judge awarded sole custody of the unborn child to Donnie's father until his 18th birthday, at which time said custody will revert to Donnie. A third unintended outcome of this union between student and teacher is Donnie becoming an overnight media sensation and minor celebrity. Fast forward 27 years to present day, read 2012, and Donnie's lifestyle has finally caught up with him, and he owes $43,000 to the IRS for ba unpaid back taxes, and will be going to jail unless he gets the money before next Tuesday, since Monday is Memorial Day. Despite his earlier fame, Donnie only has $28 to his name, and his son, Han Solo Burger, walked out of his life when he turned 18. It has been at least 9 years since Donnie has seen or heard from his son, but all that changes when he sees the wedding announcement of Jamie Martin to Todd Peterson. He may no longer be going by Han Solo, but one look at Mr. Peterson and Donnie knows, that's my boy! Learning that Todd is now a successful hedge fund manager, Donnie decides against asking him for the money, and instead approaches TV host Randall Morgan to arrange a paid appearance on his show. Randall offers Donnie $50,000 in cash if he can get his son to the facility where his mother is imprisoned for a reunion this coming Saturday. All out of options, it seems like Donnie is going to his son's wedding. When Donnie arrives at the beachfront property of Todd's boss, where everyone will be staying for the wedding festivities, he learns that Hansi has not only taken a new name, but developed an entire new life for himself, where he was orphaned at age 9 when both of his parents were killed in an explosion. Thus, rather than be there as father of the groom, Donnie is attending as Todd's best friend, who saved him from getting hit by a train when he dropped his burrito on the tracks and inexplicably went to retrieve it. Soon, Donnie is the life of the party, even before being recognized as a kid who got get his teacher pregnant, and Todd's anxieties about living in his father's shadow begin to reemerge. Though now, as an adult, he's able to actually confront Donnie and express his frustration. Being such a magically accepting person, Donnie takes the criticism to heart and begins doing what he can to repair the relationship, which is perfect, since Todd is going to need his father's help to avoid marrying his brother fucker of a fiancé and ultimately learning the true meaning of happiness.
I don't know. You didn't focus enough on the teacher relationship at the beginning for me. Yeah, I'm going to need another 10 minutes on just that, please.
Oh, okay. I mean, I feel like all I focused on in that was the teacher relationship. Because in addition to the fact that it is there in the beginning and then largely in the background of this film.
Yeah.
It's kind of the only thing that you can actually hang your hat on. Because the rest of this film is a whole sort of general mishmash of shit that they think will be funny.
Yeah.
Like, there's structure to this film.
No, it is a bunch of bits. It is just bit after bit after bit. And, like, some of them are not bad bits. Some of them are terrible bits. Not, like for a group of people that I love watching so much on screen, because in all of this, you have guys like Will Forte showing up on screen. I mean, even Rachel Dratch, who's been showing up in Sandler movies before, being phenomenal.
Ironically,
stuff.
In another villain piece, Chuck and Larry, she made her debut.
But like, you know, you have all of these really interesting, like James Caan showing up as the priest. I mean, like, there's just so much.
Susan Sarandon and her daughter, Eva Amari, playing her younger version.
Yeah.
Like, that blew my mind. Like, it was like, what the fuck is this movie when Susan Sarandon showed up to play the older version of her daughter? Like,
for all of that, there's just nothing. There's just jokes that are just, there are just moments and jokes that are just there just to get a laugh and then never addressed or needed ever again. Like, it's just such a bizarre structure of a film from what we've seen so far. Not in the grand scheme of things, because like the idea of just structuring together a bunch of just bits has made some people's careers in film. But like, it's just in what we've seen in the Sandler movies so far, it feels like the most meandering of all of his movies, just so that they can do A, B, or C. Like, and again, this is something that he often gets accused of, is this idea of just bullshit for bullshit's sake, just so that his friends can be on screen, just so that he can get the bad joke. Like, all of this sort of shit that he's often accused of, and we have time and again pointed out how some of that stuff is not factually evident in his earlier movies. Suddenly you watch this one and you're like, this is everything everybody's ever said about him and his comedy.
I mean, I don't want to step on what might be your new old borrowed or blue here, but if one of the criticisms of Adam Sandler is that he's just making these movies to hang out with his friends, the only friends that appear on screen are Nick Swardson in a semi, like, meaty role as Kenny, his friend at the strip club.
Yeah.
And Peter Dante showing up at the wedding at the end, right? Like, I mean, yeah, Dan Patrick has shown up in a bunch of movies, and we might look into that a little bit deeper.
Well, and we haven't looked too far forward into this sort of stuff, but him and Sandberg end up doing a ton of stuff together. Not just the Hotel Transylvania movies as well, but I mean, like, Sandler has a really early first season cameo on Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Season 1, episode 15, Operation Feather Strike.
Yeah, which feels like it's a real, like, it's a real, like, pat on the shoulder, like, you got this kid moment when Sandler shows up in Sandberg's, like, new hit show at that point.
Right.
Like, it feels you know, so their relationship is long, right? Like, and
I mean, he showed up at Andy Sandberg's wedding as the character of Donnie Berger. Right. Full costume, like, it's a known thing, and he did it because he was invited to the wedding and thought it would be funny. Like, this establishes that relationship with Andy Samberg. Again, I don't want to cannibalize our later segment, but talk about, he's going to show up with these things. The covert covert in this movie is actually the most covert covert because he is a radio host for less than 30 seconds of the opening of That's My Boy.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, I really hoped that Alan Covert would show up again. in some way, shape, or form as that shock jock sort of DJ, especially right. since it's set in the Boston area. And we know, living in the Boston area, how those guys are sort of the same level of celebrity as somebody like Donnie Berger in this film.
In that area, for sure, yes. Yeah, there's the movie just doesn't know what it wants to do. Also, I mean, let's talk about it because you've already read the synopsis, so spoilers are out the window now at this point, right? You hinted at it, but man, did you gloss over the resolution of this film, which led me to write down what might be the worst note I've ever written about any of these movies. That's My Boy is a quote-unquote comedy that dares to ask what's worse, child molestation or sibling incest?
Wow.
Like, we get to the end of this movie, and the resolution is that this fiance that has been kind of horrible already this whole time, which I don't know why that couldn't have been enough for him to be like, I deserve better than this. Like, no, we had to throw in that she is sleeping with her brother. And, like, it is, again, reveled in, not nearly as long as the opening of this movie, but man, that scene in the hotel room with him puking into the ice bucket is, like, egregiously long for what it needed to be. But that is the resolution of this movie, and I have to be honest, in that moment, I am then forced to ask the question, well, is this as bad as the fact that he slept with his teacher, like, when he was 13? Not on Donnie, because Donnie is a child in that incident and cannot be held accountable for what's going on, but, like, that this is not the worst thing we've seen in this movie, and I hate saying that, but it's true.
I mean, we did see Will Forte get a blowjob from a lady in a neck brace, like full on bleed for this neck brace.
Right.
I can't think of what that guy's name is. Miles Teller's played him in the movie.
Oh.
he's a real guy. He's a boxer from Rhode Island. I should know his name, but I don't really care about him. Yeah, it's really like that moment of the incest. Here's the thing. Here is the moment. When Chad first shows up in this movie, played by This Is Us
actor. I was thinking Heroes, but yeah.
Well, This Is Us, man. This Is Us is where I go for Milo Ventimiglia. Because Milo Ventimiglia is going to be dining out on his This Is Us money for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
There's no way he's not going to.
Yeah.
It's one of those situations where it's a Will moment, right? It's a moment with Will where he watched
killed by an air conditioner on that show. Sorry, go ahead.
No, he died of a heart attack. Spoilers for season 5 of This Is Us. They really made it seem like he died in a fire. Turns out he survived the fire, but the stress of getting everybody out of the house gave him a coronary like incident.
Jesus.
And then he died because of that heart like attack that was brought on from the stress of having to get his family out of the burning house.
And then in this film
he fucks his older sister and calls it their secret tickle time.
Oh,
while also false fucking valoring as a Marine. Like,
that might
come
be
on
worse than the incest there, buddy. Like, oh my god.
Yeah, it's one of those situations in this film where when Chad first showed up, because he pulls up in a taxi and Leighton Meester, which I am so sorry, Leighton Meester, I have nothing but apologies for the fact that you were one of my favorite actors, and now retroactively, after seeing you in That's My Boy, it's going to be very difficult to root for you. I loved you in Making History. I loved you in Single Parents. But dear fucking God, if Jesse chooses you over Sophie and How I Met Your Father, I'm gonna burn buildings to the ground.
The big thing for me is I like okay. Wait, no. How are you in this role? Did you get that script? And decide to do this movie.
I get to work with Adam Sandler. That's it. That's the only way that you're okay with it. It's one of the.
Sorry, you were making a point.
I was making a point, and that is the point. So he shows up in the taxi, and she goes, "Oh my God, Chad is here!" Right now, first of all, his name is Chad. Right, which should red flag should already be going off in your head, but the fact that she doesn't go, oh my God, my brother is here, or oh my God, some like cutesy nickname for her brother is there. I didn't think Chad was her brother in that first moment. I thought that maybe he was like a longtime childhood friend, or like his parents died and then the Martin family took him in.
He shows up on screen, I was like, oh, he wants to fuck his sister. I didn't realize how right I was.
That's the thing. It was that moment where, like, he picks her up and hugs her, where I'm like, oh, so he can't be related to her. And then he's like, oh, you enjoy fucking my sister? And I'm like, oh, they are related. That was kind of a misstep on the movie, because I really thought that he was going to be like a weird rival for her affections. However, he's been away at war, and that's why he can't be a part of it. But no, I guess if he's just the brother, then he's the rival in the fact that I'm protecting my sister. Then lo and behold, they're fucking. They're definitely fucking. Fucking. Like, ugh. It's one of those things where, like, I asked Dale if she saw this movie, and she's like, yeah, we saw it together. Now, first of all, we did not see it together. There's no way I saw That's My Boy. I have substantiated evidence from social media posts and all sorts of stuff that says that I did not see That's My Boy until March of 2022. And I'm not, like, trying to fight for it. There's no way that this is a movie that I saw and then I thought, like, I guess it's good for the third villain movie. Right? Like, there's no way you could have seen this movie and been like, it should be the third one that we watch.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, if I had ever seen this movie before, it would have been May's episode, because it takes place over Memorial Day weekend. That's the type of shit I love. The fact that it's happening in March, I'm so disappointed in myself.
Yeah, you don't have to defend the fact that you saw this movie before and you liked it so much you wanted to do it again.
I never saw the movie. But I brought it up with Dale and I asked her if she had ever seen it, and she says, we will never speak of that fucking movie, because that scene at the end of the movie makes it unforgivable and undiscussable. Like, that's where Dale is at the big reveal that Leighton Meester is fucking her brother, Milo Ventimiglia.
Yeah. No, it's a weird, and you know, it's like,
oh, wait, just to finish the other thing, Will brought up, I watched The Art of Racing in the Rain. I don't know if you're familiar with that movie.
I actually am. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is, I picked up Will from the airport, and he's like, yeah, I watched a good movie on the plane, The Art of Racing in the Rain. It features that guy from This Is Us. So that's where Milo Ventimiglia is, right? Though I would really love if after this episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, we turn him into, oh, Milo Ventimiglia, that guy who fucked his sister and That's My Boy. Let's do it. Let's make a positive change in this world.
Oh, my God.
Mandy Moore deserves better.
Oh, shit. It's just, the problem is like, I get that idea that, like, this is the idea that this is the resolution of this movie is batshit insane, but only secondary to the first 15 minutes of this movie that are so batshit insane. There's so much other horrible shit that happens in this movie that by the time we get to that, it is no longer the worst thing we've seen.
Yeah.
It just isn't. But the crazier thing about that is that the movie, for as insane and disgusting as it is, it doesn't earn this one. Like, the moment when it turns out that, like, everybody has been sleeping with grandma is a naughty joke, right? Like, it is, on the one hand, I want to applaud this movie for the ways in which it portrays sexual activity amongst aged women in particular. Like, awesome. Well, on the other hand, like, this idea that they keep talking about grandma being a whore and, like, being the joke is, like, really fucked up. And that idea that, like, this movie, though, gets to that point, like, for lack of a better term, earnestly, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't get to there with incest. I'm sorry. You don't get to, like, there should have been more hints of something weird earlier.
I have to ask you a sincere question right now. And it's a bit of a task. So if you're willing to do a task, when did Game of Thrones premiere?
I don't know, but Ed Sheeran wasn't in it until season 3 or 4, I believe.
Okay.
So if Ed Sheeran has the joke at the end, because, yeah, by the way, Ed Sheeran shows up as himself in his movie, guys, and he has the joke about how he was on Game of Thrones, like, that had to be about season 3 or 4, because that's when that was one of the first incidents of people starting to bitch about that show and about how things had gotten out of hand with Game of Thrones. And then eventually, you know, you had things like people just leaving fucking Starbucks cups on set and, like, you know, the entire 8th season.
Wait, Ed Sheeran is not in this movie, is he?
Are you fucking? Oh no, I'm sorry. I just watched Red Notice. I was
You're
confusing
thinking
the
of a
two.
different movie.
I watched this movie and then I had to do something, so I
To
watched
cleanse your
Red
palate.
Notice.
I get
That's
it.
the palette, and I forgot Ed Sheeran's at the end of that one. Sorry. Let me look it up.
Yeah. Because I feel like with the
Man, I must
eighth
have sounded like a
season.
crazy person.
You did! I'm
Sitting
like,
there
what? Did I miss Ed Sheeran? Does Seijin think Vanilla Ice is Ed Sheeran?
Yeah, there you go. This is a good time for us to now talk about Vanilla Ice. That's really what I
Yeah,
was doing.
this I'll vamp with Vanilla Ice while you look up when Game of Thrones came up. We can stop, collaborate, and listen once you get back with that information. Yeah, because Vanilla Ice shows up in this movie because we have Donnie Berger become this overnight media sensation and minor
2011.
celebrity. 2011. Okay, so that is the only reason why I feel like this movie must have thought we can do an incest storyline
Oh, the seal's been broken,
with
right? Like,
almost with almost
okay.
nothing to substantiate it.
Okay. That actually weirdly makes me feel better. All right, now let's talk about Vanilla
Let's
Sheeran.
talk
What's
about
going on?
let's talk about Vanilla Ice. Rob something. I only know that because he's in the Bob's Furniture commercials with Rob Schneider.
Did you know he's apparently a huge asshole too?
What, Vanilla Ice?
Vanilla
Uncle
Ice, yeah.
Vanny?
Yeah,
No, but he works with Todd Bridges. What you talking about, Seijin?
Yeah, we've learned that over the last couple of years that he's not great.
Yeah, there's a reason why I am a big fan of Partners in Crime, TURTLE Power, and not a huge fan of Vanilla Ice's Ninja Rap. Let's just be honest. Partners in Crime, not huge assholes. At least not in any way that I'm aware of.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, so Vanilla Ice is like the big celebrity buddy grab for this movie, right? Like you have your reach back to old Hollywood with the likes of James Caan and, as we mentioned earlier, Susan Sarandon. But the like getting like Mike Tyson to show up, or like getting your, or what's the one in That's My Boy? Not no, this is That's My
Oh,
Boy.
it's
What's the
actually
one in
Vanilla Ice, and that's my boy.
No. Lou Ferrigno in
And I Love You, Man?
I Love You, Man, right?
Yeah.
Like it's
Or Wilson
that role.
Phillips in Bridesmaids.
Yeah, that role being filled by fucking
By Vanilla
Vanilla
Ice.
Ice in this movie is such a weird, like, clearly the guy knows how to make a joke at his own expense though, right? Like him pissing in the bush was actually legitimately like a funny
Dude.
bit because of how much I don't like Vanilla Ice,
The
so.
best line from Vanilla Ice in this movie is, "Are you kidding me? Queen got 50% in that song. Suge took 60%. It costs me money whenever they play that shit." Like it's like Vanilla Ice is on fire in this movie, and it actually makes me happy, but it's like an important distinction as to why somebody who became an overnight sensation in the 80s, this time of excess where like really we were making anybody a celebrity, would have only $28 to his name in like 20 years, 30 years later. Like it makes all this sense, like
Well, and very specifically, one that is like, by all accounts, as much of an asshole as he may be, is still healthy and like, in
Yeah.
doing shit in the world. Like, he's got his like home renovation show or whatever the fuck it is he does now. But like that idea that he has not gone completely off the deep end in some sickening way, like I mean, they make jokes about guys like Gary Coleman and stuff like that in this movie, and like I by 2012 wasn't Gary Coleman already dead? Like, Jesus, guys,
Well, I
like,
mean, they make those jokes because Todd Bridges did play Willis in Different Strokes.
I
Like,
know,
I
like
just
that
want to
idea
make
that
sure, because that was
parts
something
of the
that
jokes.
I had to confirm for
Oh,
myself.
right. No,
Like,
but you cannot tell me that there's not some like ghosting of this idea of the 80s child star that has been burned out in this movie that is going on, and like you don't get to talk about Mr. Drummond and not think about Gary Coleman,
oh yeah.
right?
Well, I mean, the
Right.
fact that Todd Bridges also works at the same ice rink as Vanilla Ice is really just indicative of the way that we chewed up and spit out these child stars of the 80s, which is this really like weird underlying current and thesis that That's My Boy has.
Man, I wish Ed Sheeran had been in this movie.
He wasn't a thing yet,
That
was
scene
he?
was so good in Red Notice. It
It
would
was
have
very good in Red
been.
Notice. All right, we're not talking about that. And in fact, I think now is a pretty good time to interrupt what we're talking about because I know there's so much more and jump into something new, something old, something borrowed, something boo. Blah, 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 blue. Blah,
Something boo.
blah.
What
Something
happened to Hotel
boo!
Transylvania?
That's for Hotel Transylvania. So we're here. We're at this is what we do on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. It's kind of a quick, rapid fire sort of thing to spark conversation, talking about the new elements.
No, it's not. Sorry, go ahead.
That's what's written down in my schedule. I'm going off of the schedule today. So we talk about something new that would be introduced to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe if this film is part of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Something old, something that's already existed in previous ASCU films. Something borrowed from the rest of Hollywood. And something blue, the definition of which is highly debated between me and Seijin.
Yeah, so we normally go back and forth on these when one of us feels like we have a good bit, then we hold on to it. But where do you want to go, Deb?
Why don't you go first on this one?
Okay, so there's a lot of weird old that I kind of wanted to point to in terms of like, you know,
but we start with new, Seijin.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, forget you do new old. I always do old new. So let's go with new then. Nudity. there's some new faces you could definitely point to. We've mentioned guys like Sandberg and Forte and stuff like that already, but like the thing that I really want to draw attention to is like R-rated and like full of nudity and all sorts of nudity, not just like Chuck and Larry. There is a level of female skin on screen that becomes rather uncomfortable because of like implications and there's a certain type of sex that is portrayed in that movie, straight heterosexual sex, right? In this movie, everybody fucking. And, like, I'm kind of down with that. Like, I do want to make sure that I give this movie credit for this particular element of it. The idea that I talked about earlier with older women, but not just older women, like, all different body types, like, all sorts of stuff, like, on display. Like, there is a lot of positive sex stuff. The problem is it's all fucking underwritten by the negative sex stuff in the child sexual activity, the child like sexual assault in the beginning of this movie, and the incest at the other end. This movie is bookended by like terrible examples, so like it loses all clout for the rest of it, right? But it should be noted that this is the first one that we have watched that has had just an excess of nudity. It's never been a thing in Sandler movies before for us.
Yeah, I mean, as much as there's a moment where you get to see Tia Leone like artfully nude in Spanglish,
right,
this movie is a hard fucking R, to the point that I went through all of Adam Sandler's R-rated movies to see if this was actually the first hard R Adam Sandler film. And you know what? That research got real easy when I found out that on the first pass through the MPAA, this got an NC-17 rating.
Yeah. You see, and I have to think that this is at that time of like, you know, you're getting kind of towards we're full force into like the American Pie like effect, right? Where like
American Reunion comes out this same year. So
yeah, so like this idea that like the gross out R-rated comedy that's not afraid to go too far is like kind of a thing in the 2000s, and we're kind of at the end of that, and we're slowly moving into like the more thoughtful R-rated comedy, like why can't R-rated comedy still be good movies era, right? Mm-hmm. And this movie tries to be the best of both of those worlds by having these heartfelt moments, but then at the same time leaning into this sort of shit, like just excessive nudity and excessive sex on display and things like that. And like right up front in the beginning of this film, I mean, like I can think of the breakfast scene sitting at the strip club, right? Like that sort of shit. Like it starts
her
and
drinking that orange juice upside down, though. It does it for me.
Oh, that bit. See, that's one of the bits that works for me. Her doing the entire breakfast, not just the drinking the orange juice, but she goes, "Just give it to me. Donnie doesn't mind." And then she starts eating it upside down, and she commits so friggin' hard to eat that entire plate of food and then drink that orange juice upside down.
Yeah.
It was hilarious. That moment was legitimately funny.
Yeah. Excellent. Wonderful. But yeah, NC-17. And the crazier thing, there's no unrated version of this movie. Because they just resubmitted it as it was and were able to get an R rating from the MPAA. No, like, there's
no, this is an Adam Sandler movie. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Let us knock
that down. Oh, I'm sorry. We'll give it an R. Yeah. Like, Little Nicky, I think, had an R rating, right? Yeah, we're fine. We're fine with
R
this.
For royalty.
Yeah, it's just... It's crazy that this is an NC-17 Adam Sandler film. Because it's not like it got an unrated version. It's not like... And that's also speaks to something crazy about someone like Adam Sandler, who, when he submits this movie to the MPAA and they're like NC-17, He doesn't go and then try to edit it down to get the R rating. He's like, eh, we'll wait a month and then resubmit.
I mean, someone might say he swings his dick around and says, you know, I'm Adam Sandler. I'm going to resubmit this and you're going to reconsider it. And
exactly.
Like, yeah.
No, that's the thing. But I mean, that's also the thing is it, like, even if he's just swinging his dick around, we're going to wait and then resubmit it of it all is crazy. Yeah. To the fact that there are probably MPAA members who went from an NC-17 to a R who were just convinced that they had changed something. Because that's what was being done with these movies at the time.
Well, remember, like, we know a little bit more about this way this stuff works. All credit to This Film Is Not Yet Rated, wonderful documentary. But the idea being that sometimes the entire group of them doesn't watch all of these movies. They get so many movies submitted that it's really down to one person. And this is kind of true also in academic journalism, for anybody that's wondering. You can submit it to the same source. You submit it to the same fucking address. They pick it up, and one person watches it and says this, this, and this about it. And you get that response back, and you can say, I don't like that. And the secret is you can resubmit it, and you're pretty much guaranteed it's going to go to a different person. Yeah. So it's not even that somebody there just thought maybe something changed. Literally all it was is it just exposes the joke of the MPAA is that it's all subjective. And one person who saw it after that deemed it actually an R. And then once they got that R rating, they ran hightail out of there and didn't submit it again. Because, like, there's no way they were getting less than that, right? But, like I am of the opinion that what probably happened is they hit one submission and didn't get the response they wanted. And because Adam Sandler is Adam Sandler, he was able to resubmit without any questions asked. And, like, I think that is where the system breaks down. There should be some evidence that something was done to the movie. You don't get to just, like, that you shouldn't be able to just resubmit the same thing. Yeah. But all they did was hit a different reviewer, and boom, they got their R rating, and they were like,
good, and then they're like, good, we're fine with that. Thank you.
Right.
Which also, isn't that kind of strange that we just go with the lowest rating that's assigned to it? There's no sort of, like, judicial review from other people.
Yeah, right. But the
we're not here to talk about the MPAA.
Is maybe that's where the $70 million comes from? Is that they maybe because
they paid it off?
It's not cheap. No, it's not that they paid somebody.
Oh yeah,
it's literally like other movies don't have this option. Like this speaks to Sandler and speaks to something that's going on at this point in his career. Is he literally has the money to resubmit in a way that other people don't? So it's not even just that this shouldn't have been allowed without any edits. Resubmission just shouldn't be allowed in general because the rich get to do it as many times as they want. And independent filmmakers do not get that sway. And so, like, it just speaks to the two, again, Sandler swinging his dick around with this movie, which is crazy to me because there's so much going into this now of thinking about, like, this is the movie that Sandler wanted to make. Like, there isn't anybody else to point to here at this point. Like, Happy Madison Productions wanted this movie to be the movie we saw.
Yeah. I mean, it also... I don't know if that would go into the budget, right? The budget is all upfront costs, right?
Yeah,
to make the film. That would be like in that marketing budget stuff where like
Hollywood
we
magic.
All know that it's insane. So, but also think about what this would have done if it had gone out with an NC-17 rating, right? They're already saying, fuck it. We're not going to shoot for the PG-13. We're going for the R. Imagine if they had said, yeah, we're going to release this NC-17 movie. It would have been a big draw to audiences. Cause really the only other mainstream NC-17 film that I can think of is Henry and June from 1991.
Well, part of the reason for that is that you're not going to get a theater to touch it if it has an NC-17.
But you have Adam Sandler, right? Is that enough? Is that enough to do it? Like it could have and would have been this really interesting like academic case for is the rating that much of a turnoff to it? I mean, especially in 2012, where like the raunchier the comedy, the better in terms of your audience, right?
Yeah, this stuff comes in waves in terms of like us being kind of like more forgiving and less forgiving of like raunchy comedy and matter in our entertainment and stuff like that. And we've obviously moved away from it. Like the tide has gone out on it for now, but eventually it's going to come back. And I wonder if the next time it comes back harder because it seems like every time it has, right?
Yeah.
Like, and if next time that this like, you know, in like 2030s when suddenly people rediscover like the American Pie series and they're like, we want to make a movie like that. Then suddenly they usher in this whole new wave of just over the top raunch comedy that does eventually break that barrier, you know?
Yeah. It'll be interesting. It'll be an interesting thing. Which brings me to my new, because I still haven't shared my new. And again, I haven't seen a lot of these movies, but it's definitely the first movie that we've watched as part of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast where Tom Brady is referenced at all. Like, you need to think about the fact that Tom Brady...
Look at that,
by Rex Ryan, too. Yeah, which, yeah. Like, the fact... I would love to point out the Rex Ryan of it all, but the fact that by 2012, Tom Brady is a reference point for these movies that are taking place in Boston. This is a man who's been playing in the NFL for at least 11 years at this point.
Right.
And it's just so crazy, especially when you think about something like Ted also came out in 2012 and had those Tom Brady references. Like, this is where Tom Brady officially is a part of popular culture in a way that he is referenced. In cinematic features.
I mean, it's him becoming more celebrity than
player. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Man. Yeah. Watch the Brady poster, man. Man. Yeah. The need to really establish that this is Boston was a little grating, and like I actually watched, for anybody that really wants to put a timestamp on this, we are in the midst of a really unfortunate conversation about an Oscar-nominated film this year. Sam Elliott has made some comments about how...
Power of the Dog, baby!
Power of the Dog being filmed in New Zealand somehow makes it less of a Western. I'm not quite sure he's paid attention to Westerns in the last 20 years, but they're all filmed in Australia.
Oh, what was that? Hello, Italy's calling.
And then you got to go back to spaghetti westerns. But yeah, New Zealand and Australia are two huge locations for this kind of
thing. The Outlaw Josie Wales is an Australian film.
So there's been a lot of discussion with people being like, oh, I agree with Sam Elliott. Everything looks like New Zealand to me. So like, it doesn't look like the West. And
it
like,
looks
and
like the Shire, Dad. I can't enjoy it.
But so I've been trying to stay out of that conversation because I just don't buy it. Like I have the ability to be told this is where we're supposed to be. And even if I don't like immediately like agree with it, I can at least live with it enough to enjoy the thing, right? I mean, like, I was in theater for years, so I walked into black boxes and people were just like, look at this forest that we're in, look at the magical fairies, and I just had to do that, right? So like, anybody that's watched one iota of Sesame Street can deal with that as far as I'm concerned.
One would
right?
certainly hope so. So Sam Elliott probably hasn't watched an iota of Sesame Street, if we're going to be honest. it feels like, that's not my bag.
So when I'm watching this movie and it just aggressively is like, we're in Boston, everybody talks like this now. And it's just like, I get it, guys. And I was trying to figure out, it was like, oh no, is this what he means when he says that he doesn't see Montana in the New Zealand? And I was like, no, this isn't it. This is just, it is grating in just how much they want us to believe it's Boston. Just tell me it's Boston and move on.
Dude, what's worse is the fact that, yeah, it's fucking Boston.
Yeah,
like,
right.
There are landmarks. The craziest thing is...
They are definitely at a really nice house on the Cape.
I've driven by the house. But, like, the one that really hit it is wherever in the very beginning of the movie where Donnie brings Mrs. McGarrickle the, like, four-pack of wine coolers, I've driven by that house. I will be driving by that house on Sunday. Like, that's not like some like magical house or anything like that. It's just a well-known house in Somerville. It's just a beautiful, and I know it because it's yellow, and I honk my horn whenever I drive by yellow houses, which we'll talk about that on the Save Report eventually.
I just, at the end of the day, like I get it. Like, they're on a different part of the country than usual. Like, it's just that, like,
but
this is
are
just
they?
One of those movies.
Is it? It's one of those things where Boston really became a place to set your story.
Yeah.
Like in the wake of something like Fever Pitch. So even though Adam Sandler, he's from New Hampshire and he did plenty of stuff with Boston, like all the Boston Bruins shirts and hats that he has worn over the years, it doesn't need to be aggressively Boston, but like that is what we were told Hollywood by Hollywood audiences needed to see to understand that it was Boston.
Yeah, I mean, like you got to remember that Fever Pitch is definitely a moment to point to in terms of Boston. But really, it's the Red Sox winning the World Series. All eyes are suddenly on Boston. It becomes the thing, and Fever Pitch just like is really the first prime example of like somebody taking full advantage of everybody being a Bostoner for those few years.
Was it also 2011 that year that like the Celtics won, the Bruins won, there was a crazy year
where like Boston was just the winning city.
So it also makes a lot of sense that repping Boston, especially imagine if you're Adam Sandler and you've probably been a fan of Boston sports teams your entire life, and like suddenly you want to be proud of your heritage as a Boston boy. But like that's the way. I mean, look, even going back as far as something like Good Will Hunting, that like this is what Boston looks like. Yeah. Boston is Southie. And that's also crazy, like that whole moment where they're in Southie and the people are just having sex in their car for some reason.
I don't know.
The Capitol Diner, which like I'm like, isn't that in Worcester? But it's not. It's in Boston. But like there's a very similar one because Worcester wanted to try to crib those people from Boston. It's just And it's doubly weird for someone, for us, for you and I, people who grew up sort of in that aura of Boston pride.
Yeah. Like, but that's what I mean is like, as I can see it, I can love it, I can be in it. And this, and I want to make it clear, this is not just this movie. I think where I draw the line on the whole, like New York is a character within itself in the movie is like, I'm totally down with that. I'm totally down with you telling me it's New York and maybe you filmed it on a lot in LA, but I can get over that. My problem is when you so aggressively want me to believe that you did this thing, and maybe here it's that they really aggressively want to show off that they did do this thing. Like, see, we did shoot in Boston. We're telling you it's Boston and it is. It's like, that's great, guys. Like, I don't need it anymore. They just, everything is a Boston joke.
Yeah. It's, I mean, even the bacon and legs thing for that strip club, that's so aggressively the foxy lady.
Yeah.
Which is not even Boston. But what are you going to do, right? That's how the Hollywood sees us. Let's move on to Old and taking the reins here, driving the car. It is not just the fact that this is supposed to be the same character from the psychotic story of Uncle Donnie from Sam and Judy's Kid, because it's the voice he's doing, the way he's acting, aside from the homicidal tendencies that character has in that skit. Like, right. It's very much that character, the way that he approaches things. But then also with something else, which I guess this is the time to do it. Donnie Berger is the most accepting character that Adam Sandler has ever played. Fight me on it. I can't get over the fact that, like, his friend in 1984 being like, oh, I'm not into girls either. Like, coming out to him as a homosexual and him being like, no, I don't mean it like that. I mean, I'm into women. Like, he doesn't make fun of that kid for saying that he's gay. Like, he just totally is like, no, I don't mean it like that. Sorry. I mean it like this. But the way that he treats the strippers like real people, the way that he treats everybody like a real person, like one of the most egregious ones is the fact that Tony Orlando, because Tony fucking Orlando's in this movie as Steve Schirripo, Steve Spiro, has the two Asian, the butler and the maid at his beach house are both played by like Asians, and he treats them like fucking shit, except for Donnie, who is like, first of all, like very kind to them. And then there's that moment where he makes them breakfast and then says to them, I'm going to go take this phone call. Don't clean up. Like, literally, you are the guest right now. I'm taking care of you. Yeah. And it's the fact that he sleeps with grandma and the fact that he sees grandma as somebody that he can jerk off to. Like, it's
fucking crazy, man. This character has to be possibly the sweetest character.
He's the kindest character.
Like, maybe short of Little Nicky. It comes from a very different place, right? Like not only is he kind in this movie, but he's also extremely confident in himself.
Yeah.
Like he's just like, there's the only place where he feels he falters is as a father, right? Other than
Right.
that, he seems
And
pretty
even
comfortable
then,
with who he is in
he
life.
doesn't see himself as faltering as a father until his son points out those things that he did that were detrimental to his development.
Right.
Like, there's that moment where he's like, you know, I let you do this and I let you do that. And he's like, yeah, but you shouldn't have let me do that because you were the parent. But then, like, even deeper than that, like, the deeper thing is we don't ever see Donnie's father, but we are told that he is an abusive person who will kick his ass if he is out of line. And the most we see of his father is his fist in the courtroom when he's, like, proud of the fact that he got his adult girlfriend pregnant.
Right, right.
So it also truly tracks that he would not want to be that authoritarian, abusive father figure to his own son.
Yeah.
Like, like they put in all this fucking work for, like, why Donnie would be the type of father that he was to Han Solo.
Right.
And it's like, why did you guys do this? Why did you do this in this film that, like, flat out doesn't deserve it? It doesn't deserve the care that you put into this character and this narrative based on everything else that's going on.
I think the secret is that the nugget of this film, right? Because everything starts with that kernel, that idea. The idea had to be he wanted to just do a father-son comedy, but he wanted the son to be aged up so that they could do this adult R-rated style comedy, right? Like, he didn't want to be doing another family movie, another grown-ups. He wanted to be doing something else. And so this idea that he wants that comedy, and then the question becomes that, like, well, how much do we age the kid up? Because you're going to be so old. Like, what are we doing here? Are you going to be an old man? Is the kid going to be a 20-year-old? No, I want it to be like, you know, a 35-year-old.
I want it to be like a Dystaff Gilmore Girls. Can
right.
we do that?
And
Can we make
that goes,
happen?
Well, that would make you like 13 when you had him. Boom. That's like the bit, right? And it grows from there. So, like, with that, it means that all the love and care is going to be put into all of this stuff of developing him as a father. Their figure and why he is the way that he is, and the son and the way that he is. Because, as I said earlier, this is a dual like movie. Like, this is a dual-fisted movie because you have Sandler with all of this stuff, but through Sandler's story, we are then also given pretty much the same amount of care to Todd's background because we're present for all of Todd's background. So, like, this whole thing that we get to see done with Donnie, we also see it done with Todd. So these two characters are clearly loved by the film. And just like that is what they want to tell. It's just that then in order to tell that story, they just keep putting weirder and weirder and weirder elements and ornaments on this fucking tree. And then eventually it just looks like shit.
Yeah, I don't know. It's insane. This movie is insane with just how accepting he is of almost everything.
Everybody.
It's such a change from other characters that he's played. And like, it's why I felt weird calling this film a villain, because Donnie is sort of the furthest thing from a villain.
Yeah, the only time we see him ever call anybody out on a thing that they do is the incest stuff. Like, and it's like full blown for like 3 minutes we see him expressing his disgust with what he's come into, right? And that's the only time I think in this entire movie where he draws like a line on like a kink of some kind or anything like that.
It's a taboo set up by society, but also that's fucked up.
Right,
it's fucked up.
Right.
And since it's
really, really interesting for this for Sandler as a character creator that this is what comes out of this movie.
Yeah. I mean, and then we'll talk about a little bit further the fact why he's able to be so kind, because I'd like to work through the other this. But since my first old is being lifted from a CD, I would feel remiss not to mention the fact that the voice of Mr. Mitty, while it is very much James Stewart, is also the character of Pib from the 2004 release Shh, Don't Tell. and like, that was just very, first of all, I never knew that there was a 2004 Adam Sandler comedy CD. Found out because of this. Second of all, I saw Pib, my thought went to Pip from Airheads, and then listening to them, like, oh no, it's Mr. Mitty, right? So it's Adam Sandler really getting to relive these characters.
Yeah.
And Pib, right? Mr. Pib. They call him Mr. Pib. They don't mean DeSoto. His name is just Pib. he really is this old guy, but who also is extreme in the ways that Donnie is. So it's really interesting if you look at Adam Sandler approaching the character of Donnie Berger, that he's building this guy who like lives his life to the extreme, but also has that moral like stability of a character like Pib within it.
Yeah.
Like, it's nuts. It's really, it's cool how he takes these two existing characters from his comedy albums and is able to construct Donnie Berger.
Yeah, that's wild. That's good. My oldest, Wazza.
Wazza.
I cannot, what, like.
I mean, it's a little borrowed, but I'll let you have it.
It might be the funniest bit in this movie because it just, it keeps going and it comes from, like, culturally comes from nowhere. Like, no. Was Anheuser-Busch in on making this movie with them?
I have to imagine so. Like, he pretty much exclusively drinks Anheuser-Busch products.
Between Natty Ice
and Budweiser.
And Budweiser, yeah. That's pretty much all he drinks.
That's all he drinks. Like, it almost leads me to, like, hey, we will give you promotional consideration, but he's got to do the what's up thing. He's got to do what's up.
But why what's up? But by 2012, we were past that, weren't we?
But that's the beauty, because then you have someone like Tony fucking Orlando say, oh, is that back? Because I want it back. And this is also where I said I'd wait for later. Hey, welcome to later. This film, of all the Adam Sandler films that we have looked at, and possibly all the Adam Sandler films that we will ever look at, is really the only time that the schlub character, the buffoon character, is universally fucking beloved.
Yeah.
Like,
okay.
Like,
yeah.
I touched on it in my synopsis with the fact that, like, he is already the life of the party at that thing before people realize that he is semi-celebrity Donnie Berger. Because he's just charismatic and magnanimous, and people naturally like flock to him and want to be in the stratosphere of his character. And like, so much of that does affect the anxieties of Todd, in the fact that he's kind of camera shy and he doesn't want to be in the public eye. Now, part of that, I think, is because he doesn't want his father to be able to track him down. I'm pretty sure like that's the narrative they're trying to put together.
And just because you mentioned it and I don't have much more to say on it, it's really interesting because he does say that a few times, that he doesn't want to be able to be quote unquote found. But we also have learned that Donnie like has kind of been keeping tabs on him in one way or another and doesn't want to, like, understands that he does not want to be seen. So he's not like pursuing that. Right.
Right.
Like, he doesn't go to Todd until
he has no other options to stay out of jail. Yeah. And also there's like a really nice barrier there in the fact that he's not going to ask Todd for that money. And even if Todd offers him that money, that's not what I'm here for. I'm not here for that. I'm here because this guy offered me money. If you're willing to do this thing. And it's actually even nicer. And when he like reconnects with his son and salvages their relationship, that he's like, I'm not going to put you through this again.
No, he doesn't plan to do it.
Yeah.
Like, and he decides very early, as far as the film goes, that that's not what he's going to do.
Yeah.
Like, it is actually yet another complication when Todd decides on his own to go to the prison, and Donnie's just like, oh shit, I should stop him.
I have to stop him from going because I know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really just interesting, but it's so insane in this film, right? And Wuzz Up is the perfect example of that, because he shows up with a Wuzz Up, and then there's that scene where everybody gets in on it and everybody is part of that joke again.
Yeah.
And then that rolls into everybody just sitting at this party, mixed company, right? We're not in the fucking locker room, right? This is not locker room talk, but they have a full on locker room talk, huge air quotes conversation about all the teachers that they wanted to fuck and how they're jealous of him for actually getting to live out that dream.
Right.
And like,
because once again, this movie just like firmly just like not taking a good stance on that relationship at all.
And like, and there are women there, and the women like are kind of sympathetic and understanding. And it's like, never would fucking happen.
Yeah.
Like, and it's not like there's not a bachelor party sequence where those conversations could happen. Right.
Right.
And in fact, narratively, it's after the bachelor party where Andy Samberg's Todd admits to him, I probably would have fucked my teacher too. Right? So, like, if you have all of them have that conversation there, and it's not like I'm not supporting or celebrating locker room talk, right? That's such a bullshit thing. But those moments where, like, it's mixed company and, like, Blake Clark, which I fucking love Blake Clark. I just need to give all the credit to Blake Clark. And the fact that that man probably in real life has his nipples pierced, right? You don't do two movies where your nipples are pierced without it just being a fact that that's on your fucking resume. I'm just being honest. And I'm not judging you, Blake Clark. In fact, all the more power to you. I love that you're on the United States of Al right now because it's great to see you working. It's going to be a hard day when we lose Blake Clark for Devin Decker. I just have to admit that. I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to cry during this episode of That's My Boy. But it's just one of those situations where this world feels so diametrically opposed to every other world where Adam Sandler plays a character like Donnie Berger, and that makes him the worst person in the world.
Is it the world is different, or is it just Donnie that is just different than what we've seen before? Again, I think there's a huge difference with Donnie amongst any other character.
It's that kindness on the other level. I don't know. That's why it's gotten under my skin. That's why I'm trying to figure out this movie. It's one of those situations where, like, really the only people who don't like Donnie are Jamie for some reason. Like, I don't understand why she doesn't like him as a character. It just seems to be, like, as a way for you to understand that, like, she's bad. Because Donnie's kind of like the dog. And if she's willing to kick the dog, then she's a fucking asshole.
I mean, I think you just answered your own question. Yeah, that's legitimately why.
Right.
Because it implies something about her very early on that something is not right. Because she seems to be the only person that doesn't like Donnie.
Yeah. That makes sense. It's just, I don't know. But
I think it's really important to point out that I think the big difference with this character is this is the first time we've seen him play the buffoon, but the buffoon who is like comfortable within himself, like confident and aware of his place and happy to be in it. Like he has reached that nirvana level of just acceptance of who he is in a way that we've never seen with any other character. And that's fucking buck wild because like it is kind of like the final evolution of Sandler.
Yeah, right there. That's such Charizard Sandler right there. It's and it's so strange. I don't know. A couple of other olds just before we roll on. Adam Sandler has a real thing with characters who are either 9 years old or in the third grade. And I like that those themes both equally show up in this movie.
Yeah.
Just because he was 9 when his parents exploded and he was in third grade when he got his warped New Kids on the Block tattoo. I mean, a tattoo of tattoo is fucking hilarious. Let's just put it on the table. Let's roll forward into Borrowed, and let's hope that you going first does not fuck over mine.
I don't think so. So I like to use this time to kind of focus on some old influences that might be kind of popping up here for Sandler, because we've really noticed that there's a large trend of him just loving just Hollywood in old, new, and tropes galore. I wanted to really look at the genre, the quote toxic buddy end quote comedy, right? Because like buddy comedies always kind of depend on that element of, you know, friction, right? That idea of the person that you don't get along with, but that's what makes good one. Funny enough, Red Notice, right? Which is what I watched after this is
Jesus, really man. Like we'll talk about Red Notice on the show. Like, I'm sorry.
Just like, you know, they like look at any buddy movie, buddy cop movie, buddy up movie, like bromance, like the idea of that friction is always there.
Fuck, look but at you and me, right? I hate you, Seijin. I hate you so much.
Well, but we don't ever get to the point where it is like a toxic relationship, right? And those movies do exist. Like, I think like the only movie that I think goes further than this one in that regard might be like The Cable Guy. but this idea, right, of like the buddy comedy, but it is a very specific subgenre within that of the toxic buddy comedy. So like just looking back at older movies that do this and newer movies, you know, a really good example of this that is somewhat recent is The Trip. With Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, like it's a phenomenal
great
and
movie.
They hate each other throughout the entire movie, and there's never a moment where you think that's going to change. and like that.
I don't know when they're doing the Bane voice, or is that in the trip to Italy? Is that in the sequel?
So Michael Caine is in that one, and then I guess you're probably thinking of the sequel, yeah. The Michael Caine off though is like famous from the trip.
Yeah.
But like, like the you could even point at movies like What About Bob, the old Bill Murray movie, right? Where it's the idea that one person in the relationship is it's not just grating, they are straight up unhealthy for the other person in the relationship. And this movie wants that's the that is definitely the style that he's going for in this, right? And the problem is as you pointed out, is the toxic person in the relationship is supposed to be Donnie, obviously, but Donnie's not that toxic. He's actually a really good person trying his best, and like all he wants to do is instill more confidence in his son by the end of this movie.
I mean, the worst part about this film, honestly, the worst part about this film, and this is a film where we have talked about, opens up with a non-consensual sexual relationship between an adult and the minor, and finishes up with like incest sex that is given a cute little nickname. The worst
A
part
gross
about
little
this
nickname.
film.
Sorry. Just wanted to make that clear.
Oh yeah, no, but I mean, but that's the thing, is that like it like
Yes,
the worst part
it
about Secret Tickle Time is that as much as it is representative of just how fucked up what everything is going on, like cute little nicknames for things that are deplorable are a thing that happen in order to help normalize them or make them okay to the people who are being mistreated in those
Yeah, to the
situations.
abused in those
Yeah, like it's
relationships. Yeah.
so like it's it, it and it goes a step further when we see that Donnie is still in love with Mrs. McGarrickle, and then Chad is like, no, he's gonna tell mommy and dad about our secret tickle time. Like that infantilization of Chad in that moment is a really weird messaging on what's going on.
It's fucking
Yeah.
weird. That whole the whole turn is
Yeah,
weird.
the
And
whole,
but again,
but it's
overshadowed by the fact that this
substantiated in the
entire
freaking
movie.
movie. Like
Yeah.
it's like it's it doesn't come from nowhere, which is a real thing. But to go that step further, the worst thing in this film is that Andy Samberg is a fucking asshole. Like he plays, this has to be Andy Samberg's worst role in terms of like likability or relatability or anything like that. And it's because the fact that the toxic person in this relationship is supposed to be Donnie, but because it's a world that really sort of rewards and respects everything that he does, this kid who like just wanted a normal childhood or wants a dad who like treats him like a father and not a friend becomes the asshole.
Yeah, well, you know what it is they made this movie backwards because like the other couple of examples I was thinking of just to like give people more of an idea of what we're talking about is like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and Due Date. The speaking of Zach Galifianakis from earlier, and Robert Downey Jr. one, right? Are two other good examples of this stuff where you have that really toxic person that the straight man has to kind of like deal with. And like if we had not gotten all of Donnie's backstory. Like if it had just been kind of hinted at and told this, but then we later in the movie got to see that there was some element there that like justified whatever, like then Sandberg treating him like that at first would not feel so bad, and eventual coming around would make sense because of what he learns about his father, right? Like that's the way we tell these movies. Like look at Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and the ways in which like John Candy when he first shows up is just horrendous and a pain in the ass, but like then there's a turn in that movie where you learn some stuff about him and suddenly it changes everything. And like that's just I mean that's the kind of filmmaking we're used to. I dare say I would call it good filmmaking, right? And so, like, what happens in this movie is they want you to love Donnie so much that they tell the movie backwards, and you learn all the good shit about him up front, and he's just a good guy throughout. So, what can Sandberg ever come across as the straight man in this comedy, other than an asshole?
Yeah. It's I don't and they also give Andy Samberg's Todd character like weird things that make you that kind of make you feel the way you feel about John Candy in something like Planes, Trains, or Automobiles, or actually
I
more
like it.
specifically,
All
yeah.
I could think of is fucking the producers when
Yeah.
Matthew Broderick freaks out about his blankie.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, like, I think going a step further, like Bill Murray's What About Bob? The fact that he has those like neuroses and things,
Right.
and then it becomes sort of this way to like you view him as a certain way, and then it's weird why everybody loves Bob and everybody is like against the Doctor, who's their literal family.
Yeah.
Like it comes across weird, but like when as soon as they give him his security underwear, right, without the story, like we don't get the explanation for those until there's like 30 minutes left in the movie.
Not just an explanation, but then a justification.
Yeah. Yeah, it really goes above and beyond in those moments. But like when it's just like he keeps underwear in his pocket and rubs it when he's anxious, like it's hard to care or root for that character. Like you're doing your character a disservice. The first time that you really feel any sort of way about Andy Samberg's character is when he speaks with Bree at the strip club. Because it's the first time that he's completely unguarded and just like a regular person. And then because I've seen a movie, I'm like, oh, so he's going to wind up with Bree. And you know what? I'm here for that. I'm okay with that.
Real thing that throws me with Sandberg's whole performance, and you know, whether it's him or the script or whatever, but because of the way that he is, there's this weird moment earlier in the movie where you first meet. So the way the movie is structured is you get 15 minutes of Donnie and as a young kid, and then you montage through the credits of him growing up. But then it immediately cuts to Sandberg, and you get this like, you get the stuff of Sandberg. You never get the chance to like Donnie enough that when Sandberg first comes in, you do make some assumptions about Donnie that you then realize very quickly once he shows back up in the movie aren't true. Right, like it made me question like a lot of stuff about what kind of character Donnie was for legitimately the first 40 minutes of the movie, because I only know him as a kid, and then I know him kind of for like a couple of seconds of dialogue, and then all of a sudden all I've got is Andy Samberg's version of him, Todd's version of him, and like I don't know what to believe about that character until he finally shows up, and I have to think that's on purpose, but if it is, like I don't like it.
Right. It's all very strange. It's and I don't know. And it's this weird narrative of like, just because like we don't know what's going on between parents and their kids. Right. Yeah. Like what is presented to the world is going to be very different from the true story, because we all have a face that we keep aside forever and Billy Joel lyrics. But it's very strange.
It's only mummy gets to see.
Yeah, it's for special tickle time.
Oh god. This movie.
All right.
Yeah, so that was my borrowed.
So I'm going to go for the specific borrowed that I'm looking for in this movie is I Love You Man. You've already talked about I Love You Man, so nice job. But a very big moment in I Love You Man is Andy Samberg plays Paul Rudd's brother. And there's a moment where J.K. Simmons, who plays their father, is asked about his best friend. And he says that his best friend is Hank Mardukas, and that his second best friend is Robbie, who is Andy Samberg, so his son. And I know that this is all sorts of crazy shit.
Making me just want to watch I Love You Man.
Oh, God,
again.
I love
it. Sorry.
Such a good movie. But it comes down to the fact that there's also this fact that with 12 years between them, both in-universe and in the real world, freaking Todd Han Solo Burger is in a lot of ways Donnie's best friend.
Yep.
And Donnie is his best friend. And it feels so influenced by that one little conversation in I Love You Man that it's kind of hard to ignore.
Yeah.
It's also
I Love
this,
You Man is what, 2008?
2009.
Yeah.
Is I Love You Man. And there's also this fact with I Love You Man that I Love You Man starts this trend of films that that's my boy takes to its natural conclusion point, where Paul Rudd is not in a fantastic relationship with Rashida Jones in that movie. Yeah. Like there are things about the relationship. He was just so kind of like hyped up to get married that when he finally finds a male friend and gets to have those questions and those discussions about like, well, why are you marrying her? Is it just because society's telling you? What are those reasons? That there was a moment when I was watching I Love You Man that I'm like, oh my God, is this marriage not going to happen? And am I okay if that's what happens? But then I don't really love the messaging in it.
Yeah.
And they do end up getting married, and, you know, Paul Rudd's character, I can't think of his character's name right now, and Dale's going to kick my ass for that if he ever listens to this. Pete Klavan is his name. If they end up getting married and he finds
all over the billboards,
friends, at the end, yes, I know, that's how I did it. I saw the billboards. And they do end up getting married, but then that's my boy takes it to this natural conclusion that, like, if you're in this situation where, like, it's kind of a toxic relationship, and his relationship with Jamie Martin is hyper toxic, discounting the fucking incest.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
When she's like, it's a $12,000 Vera Wang dress, I'll wear it wherever the fuck I want. And the way that she treats him when he's in the shower and all of these things, where it's like, he would not have stopped that marriage. He would have gone through with it if his father and best friend didn't come in and intercede. And then also going with you and looking a little bit forward to, like, borrowed tropes, you get things like the wedding ringer, where, again, it's somebody coming forward and being like, are you sure this is the person that you want to marry? Are you only marrying her because you didn't have anything else and society told you you have to? Yeah. Like, it's this weird sort of start of chipping away at marriage as the end-all be-all of our journeys as humans.
I mean, you know, one of the big examples of that that I will gladly always point to is Crazy Stupid Love, right?
Yeah.
Where, like, not everybody has a happy ending in that movie. And, like, and the idea
2011
that comedy,
too, so
it's, you know, it's the, a little bit of it is the Apatowism of comedy at this point, right? Like, we're getting to a point where not everybody has to have a happy ending is kind of you know, everybody's kind of trying to do it now. It's really interesting because it does make for more complex storytelling in the long run, I think. So, like, I'm all for that. It's just that sometimes there are some movies that don't need that, or, like, I don't always want it, I guess, will be the better way that I'll put that. Right? Like, and this is not the movie that I, like, I don't know. This is just this movie is not the one that gets to be complicating that conversation.
I agree. It's very strange, but it's kind of hard not to view it as something that moved the needle a little bit forward in that type of storytelling, to the fact that, no, you know what? Ending that relationship might be the healthiest choice.
Yeah, no, because once again, Donnie can do no wrong. Like, he really can do no wrong, even to the point where, I mean, let's just say it, the end of this movie, he gets off scot-free from everything because of a one-off joke in the beginning of the movie about placing a bet.
Chekhov would be so fucking proud, though.
Chekhov's fat guy.
Brad Grunberg, too. Another carryover from Chuck and Larry.
Yeah.
Which, man. I mean, I don't know. I really, it's really weird how connected to Chuck and Larry this movie is.
Almost like the same group of people made it. But there's, there's a lot going on in terms of the borrowed, but I think we need to move on to our blues.
Yeah, it's time for Blues Clues, Sijin. And I believe I get to go first on this one, right? I think that's how it works.
Yeah, sure.
I'm going to go with that little two-year-old in the baseball scene. We haven't talked about the baseball scene. You got Fenway Park in your backyard.
The one that he flicks off, that Todd flicks off.
That Todd flips off. That kid's going to fucking win us a World Series someday. When he grabs his dick, like, fuck you. Like, that kid is fantastic. And he has on a baby blue polo that just makes him, oh, so cute. I want to squeeze little cheeks.
See, like, that's the baseball scene was actually another really good scene, because at this point we've established that Todd's a twat. Like, he has no fun. He's a weirdo, like, all of this shit, right? And so, like, that scene where he's just, like, just not participating with the family, like, he gets the baseball in the throat. He's like, don't hit it to me. And then just out like a sack of potatoes. Like, that shit is,
the ball is broken. Yeah, that's it's really nice also. Everybody catching the balls, like Blake Clark in the mug, and potentially your definition of blue, which I still don't understand, the woman who catches it between her cleavage, that would fucking hurt. Like, that's all I could think of in that moment.
Oh, shit. No, that is not my blue.
Oh, okay. But yeah, I love that kid. And I love that baseball scene. And that kid, like, I was looking through and, like, I could have gone with the blue with the swimsuit. I could have gone with the towels. There's a lot of blue in this movie. But that little kid means a lot to me in this movie.
No, I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. The bluest part of this movie is the plot line, the opening 15 minutes, because like, I cannot express like, it's not just like in a classroom and then, you know, she's like seduces him and boom, cut to the future. No, they then have to show like scene after scene of meetup after meetup of all of this. And like, why did we need to keep going back to it? I got the point after the first one. I just don't understand it. Like, and it's not like they were trying to pump this movie up, because this movie is an hour and 55 minutes long. They could have cut 10 minutes out of the beginning of this movie. I got it after the first five.
Yeah, it goes on such a long time. And also, it would be just as relatable if Donnie ended up sleeping with some girl when he was like 13, got her pregnant, and had a kid.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, because again, it's so inconsequential, the whole idea that he slept with his teachers later on. It's just something that people talk about, but he's never held accountable for it. It never gets in the way of anything. It never stops anything from happening. Is a fact about it.
That's does all it get a TV movie made starring Alan Thicke and Ian Ziering. like that's important. It's what makes him a celebrity, and honestly, it's that celebrity that might give him that freaking impervious shield.
Yeah.
and that magnanimous nature to be so beloved as the buffoon.
Right.
But there are other ways to do it. Like, it just, yeah, he could be famous for so many other ways. For it to be because he slept with his teacher, and then again, I researched too much on this, and I know it, but here's the time to bring it up. The fact that she gets 30 years in a state penitentiary for what she did is so off fucking base. Like,
I mean, yeah.
Like, even, they're like, at most, a lot of these sentences were like 6 to 7 months for statutory rape, second degree. Like, it's 30 years is almost absurd. And the only justification that I could find, right, and this is from discussing with other people about what happened, is that if the roles were reversed and it were an adult male and a female student, that would probably have been the punishment. So it becomes this sort of weird alternate dimension where that the punishment fits the crime regardless of the gender.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's also like, let's face it, at the end of the day, it's just plot convenient to make it 30 years so that you can say 30 years later. Right.
Right. I mean, and like, they only do 27 years because they're very much, she gets out in 3 years and then we'll see what happens.
Right.
Like,
I forgot there's even a bumper there. Yeah, right?
Like,
exactly. Though. But that's all it is. It's just plot convenient that it's going to be this exact amount of time.
I mean, it's like, plot convenience also if he had like gotten another girl pregnant or whatever. She would have been there. The fact that she disappears, the mother disappears for 30 years, leaving this 13-year-old to raise his son alone.
Yeah.
Like, is a real indicative part of the story. But it's just so weird. Like, I mean, I'm not a big fan of in a comedy in the first moments having the mother pass away during childbirth. But I mean, considering the alternative with like the normalization and celebration of statutory rape, like the perpetrating of that stereotype, I think I'd be okay with a Jersey Girl in this one. I have to be honest with you.
I mean, yeah, if I'm choosing between the two, I suppose.
Yeah, no. Honestly, if it's those two options, if it's a choice between a Jersey Girl and normalization of statutory rape of a female teacher of a minor student, I'm going with Jersey Girl every day of the week, and not just because of Ben Affleck. J-Lo's there, too. I love Geely.
I hope they actually are getting back together. So,
they were at the Super Bowl together.
So I'll be honest, Dev, beyond that, I don't have much more to say about this movie. I mean, like, we talked about the idea that at the end of this film, we have him get his ducats because he bets on the guy winning the race. And so, like, that's the last moments of this movie is basically him just getting his money together. So he doesn't even end up having to go to prison.
Right.
It's just like this movie it creates basically Donnie. If Donnie ever comes up against a complication, it exists for 2 pages in the script, and that's it. And like, and so there's just never a moment where you ever think anything's never going to not work for him, right? And so it's just a really wild film because for what is supposed to be the main character, because he's the first person we see and he's the last person on screen, like he doesn't grow or change at all.
And he doesn't, and he's not asked to or forced to grow or change. I mean, to be fair,
there's not even a refusal to change. Literally, the world does not need him to.
He does listen to his son's complaints and acknowledges them, but now that they're both adult males, it's not like he has to change who he is or anything differently. Right. It's like he just needs to acknowledge that as a kid, raising a kid, I could have done better. And I will do better for you now that I'm aware that I was such a disappointment to you.
Well, that's what I mean, is that, like, it's not that there's not like complications in this movie that arise. The thing is that they're resolved so quickly that there's never a moment where you're worried that anything's going to happen. And it is in the service of just having a good fucking time with some of the bits. Like, it's just, like we said before, there's such a meandering plot just to get from joke to joke. There's also, they don't want to put anything in the way. They don't want to set up a storyline that they have to resolve too many pages away from now. Like, they just want to get to the funny. And like, that is all this movie is. And I loop back around in my final thought on this whole thing to just, that has always been one of the things levied against Sandler and his movies, is that there's no meat on those bones. It is all just to get a laugh. And like, this is the first time where I feel like, yeah, I really like, this is you just kind of leaning into exactly that.
Yeah. I have to agree. I mean, we've said it before and I will say it again. This film's existence totally feels like Adam Sandler flipping the bird to all of those critiques about what an Adam Sandler film is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's frankly insane how bad a movie that actually does all of those things without any regard for what that means actually is.
I mean, but that's just it, right? Is he's always known that that would be bad movie making, which is why he's never made them that way.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Is like, yeah, it really comes down to, if these were the movies that Adam Sandler were making, as he was accused of for pretty much his entire career, we wouldn't be doing an Adam Sandler podcast right now. We wouldn't be where we are.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's and that's just the fact. Mm-hmm. I do want to, I mean, James Caan is the priest again there, and Susan Sarandon, that was like a real fucking what the fuck moment for me. Then of course I spoke too soon because it was 20 minutes later where literal incest happened in this film. Not literal incest, because Milo Ventimiglia and Leighton Meester are not related, but scriptural, literal, incest happens in this film. Which I guess comes down to and boils down to, is this in our Adam Sandler cinematic universe, Sejin? Are you putting it there? Where do you land on this film?
Yeah, you know, I gotta say, I'm very worried that it actually does fit in a lot of ways. I mean, like, and I think the reason for that is that I do think Donnie fits in really well with a lot of characters we've looked at before. Does that mean the whole movie makes it, though? I don't know. I am leaning towards the fact that it does. I mean, a lot of the stuff that we've talked about, you know, family being a key factor and there being a lot of friends around him, whether they're friends we've seen before or not, we know the relationship he has with guys like Sandberg and Will Forte and Rachel Dratch and stuff like that, right? So like,
and Dan Patrick. We never gave Dan Patrick his proper, like, but he gets a substantial role in this one.
He gets lines. Like, he's not just Dan Patrick. It's great. Yeah, like there's just so much going on that is so much of the oeuvre of Sandler. It's just that what he's doing is he's covering it all in a layer of shit, because basically at this point in his career, it seems to be all anybody's expecting of him. So he just goes for it, and that just sucks. But does that mean that it doesn't get to be in there? No, I don't think so. I think it fits.
I would want nothing more than to put this in our Adam Sandler cinematic universe. I would not nothing more, if only for the fact to have Donnie show up at the last minute in the third act of our Avengers-style Adam Sandler crossover film to knock out Eric Gordon with a fucking bottle. that I want that scene to happen so bad. I dreamt it last night.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic, right?
You know who I think gets to be in the evil is definitely definitely Milo there. What's his name? Chad. I think it's a dual package. I think it has to be Jamie and Chad.
I think it's Jamie and Chad together. Yeah, and it's one of those moments where like everybody kind of gives them side eye, like, we don't want you here. You're not fucking craziest.
She's just sitting in his lap the entire movie.
Yeah, oh God. Like, I want it to be true so deeply and so badly do I want it to be true.
I feel like there's a but at the end of this.
The fact of the matter is the world feels so different from all of the other worlds that we have put into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Talk to me more about that. What do you mean by that? Like, you don't see the ability for, like, a Billy Madison to show up in this world?
I don't see the ability for, like, a Billy Madison
to
show up.
I mean, by the way, we've never mentioned this, but, like, the guy that sleeps with his teacher. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's there's so much Billy Madison in this movie. There's so much Happy Gilmore in this movie. So much cribbed from those.
I feel like you're making my point.
I guess for me, and why we're having the discussion, why we do the show, is the fact that a world where Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, Bobby Boucher are respected, and not only respected, but accepted and celebrated the way that Donnie Berger is, it just doesn't jive for me. The way that they treat someone like Billy Madison outside of those people who are paid to like him. The way that people treat Happy Gilmore outside of, like, his family and his golf fans. The way that, like, proper society treats him. The fact that...
we haven't talked about it yet, and one day we will, but there's a weird balance of this in Mr. Deeds that'll be really interesting to explore, because in his hometown he is treated this way, but you were right, when he goes into the outside world he is the buffoon, right?
Yeah.
It's definitely a key factor for Sandler movies, cinematic universe movies, to be sure. So I agree. It's just that I do think that is, like, that's the whole point. So maybe in that is why he doesn't fit. But I do think he is designed specifically to be the anti-buffoon.
Right, and I think that... So what I would easily say is this is an alternate universe, sort of a parallel universe, of our Adam Sandler cinematic universe, where the traits that usually define an Adam Sandler character are, instead of being derided by society at large, are celebrated.
Yeah.
And then also, like, because the other thing is, like, and it's weird, and we haven't really defined how we're going to talk about the other Happy Madison productions, but Dr. Shakaloo and Dante from fucking Grandma's Boy are in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's undeniable. Dr. Shakaloo is referred to by name, and Dante, I mean, Peter Dante is called, pretty much plays characters named Peter or Dante in all of the films. And he has dreadlocks, which is very different from the Dante character in Grandma's Boy, but it kind of would check out if he were the same character. And also the grandma fucking of it all was something like Nick Swardson's character in Grandma's Boy. And then Donnie having just a go and a threesome with Vanilla Ice and Grandma Dolores. Right. Like, it and Grandma's Boy most assuredly exist in the same universe.
Yeah.
But I don't know. And also, that would also explain why Alan Covert can't show up, because he couldn't be anybody but Alex because of Grandma's Boy and just how, like, you know, influential and important that character is. But it's very hard for me to just blanket statement say that's my boy is part of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, because of the fact that it turns literally every dial up to 11 in a way that, while defining so many, like, touchstones and cornerstones of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, I think it becomes diametrically opposed to what they all stand for.
I agree on all fronts. I was not looking forward to the idea that it would be present and we'd have to talk about it more than once. Because if we banish it from the universe at this point, it means we'd never have to address it again.
And I just, here's the, here, at the very end of the day, the reason why, like everything that I just said is definitely weighing on me. But one of the reasons why I would find it hard to come to terms with this being part of everything that we've seen before is this is the least movie of the Adam Sandler movies that we have looked at. Like, this is the closest film to being a sandwich. To use that old thing, like it's a movie, it's not a sandwich. This movie's it's kind of a sandwich where they just threw in everything you like. I mean, it's a Dagwood sandwich, and yes, we touch on all of these wonderful moments, but at the end of the day, you know what it is at the end of the day? Billy
You're another
Madison.
day older? Sorry,
I'm
what?
sorry.
I was a lame ass joke. Go ahead.
Oh, it's wonderful. And there's bread, right? Billy Madison has to become the man that Victoria Veitch is wants to be with.
Right.
Happy Gilmore has to become the man that Veronica Vaughn is that, and Veitch is the other one. I got those two characters confused, right? Like, there's a journey there
Yeah,
that
the
the
character
character
needs to
needs to
grow.
go on.
And Donnie, as
Donnie
I said,
Berger
just
doesn't
doesn't.
have that journey, but also Anna Gasteyer's Mrs. Ravensdale character fucking hates him and still fucks him anyway. In what, like, I was a little surprised that wasn't your blue sequence, because I think I've cracked the code on what you're looking for. I've always known. I'm sorry for anybody who thinks I'm that thick about what blue
No, that was two
comedy
consenting
is.
adults. She said what
That's
she wanted, he agreed to it, and they did their thing.
definitely two consenting adults, but why she finds him attractive is all of those other things that repulse the characters that eventually wind up with the Adam Sandler characters in those other films.
No, oh, yeah,
And
he's got too much charisma. I get it.
I don't know. And I love Donnie Berger. And you know what? Maybe the plot line is, and it just works so well. Like, we've netted a narrative where if this exists in the universe, it's hilarious. The League of Sandler Villains with Jamie Martin purring like a fucking kitten in the lap of Chad Martin is too good a fucking visual. Donnie Berger being just a fucking screw up the whole fucking time, and then at the end of the movie, just fucking bottle to the back of Eric Gordon's head before he activates his doomsday device is fantastic. And at the end of the day, God, I wanna. I was so convinced that I would come in here and say no, but I think that all of the reasons why I want to say no are actually strong reasons for why it does. Fuck you, Sajin.
You've got me going in goddamn circles now because I agree with all of this. I think that it fits in, but I will be honest, it's not anything that I feel like fighting for because this movie really doesn't ever have to be referenced ever again, as far as I'm concerned. So like I'm down to leave it out, but I think it fits in.
All right. So I think what it is, I think what we've determined, right? And I was gonna say that grandma's boy, that sorry, that's my boy, does not, I mean, it definitely fits into the boy universe, right? We should establish and draw up the boy
The boy verse.
universe, the boy verse. Grandma's boy, that's my boy, Boyhood by Richard Linklater.
Weird how that one fits, but it
It
does.
does. It really does. If only for the fact that the girlfriend from Little Nicky is the mom in
There you
Boyhood.
go.
I can't think of her real name, and I feel
Oh,
bad
God.
about that. Something Arquette, Patricia Arquette, is that her name? It's one of those situations, and this is it's really like a teeter one, where if I went to go see the eventual Adam Sandler cinematic universe team up movie, right? The
Yes.
Adamvengers,
Yeah.
that works for me. The
No, but
Adamvengers
it's fine.
film, and it wound up that there were references to That's My Boy in it, I wouldn't be offended. Where, like, if there were references to fucking Spanglish, I'd be like, who the fuck is that for?
Who was that for? Yeah, man, it's such a weird movie. I don't know.
I mean, the sensibilities are there. The sensibilities are definitely there. And I
Yeah.
think that's it. But I don't think it adds any new commandments. I don't think anything is defined in this movie. I think this is legitimately one of the first ones where it exists in the universe, but only in the fact that, like, I'm not as offended by it as I would be if if it showed up. I don't know. I'm still, I mean, it's a yes or no. We went very black or white with this one. And I think it's a yes. I think it's a yes. Fuck. I don't want to fight for it. Maybe it'll change down the line, and I don't know.
Maybe we'll send it into the Phantom Zone.
That's my boy. Welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Please, please leave Leighton Meester and Milo Ventimiglia over in the corner, except for that one amazing scene where we see the League of Sandler villains, and like over at the end of the table is them, and like, and I'm talking like with big spaces between like Shooter McGavin and them eventually. Sorry, let me just write down welcome.
So what are we doing next time,
Dan? ASCU. Well, Seijin's dreams are coming true next episode. Because during Spanglish, he said, I'm really looking forward to watching funny people. And we're watching funny people.
Yeah.
Which is exciting. I'm actually excited. I've never seen it. I will be honest with that. I feel like I lived it when it came out, based on where I was in my life when funny people dropped in theaters.
Yeah.
But I will also say, this is, I guess, a little teaser right here. Huge fan of Judd Apatow up until Knocked Up, and then Knocked Up kind of shit its pants for me. So funny people was never something I was interested in. For as many Seth Rogans and Adam Sandlers that they were going to put into it, I really was not interested in what was going on in that film.
It's going to be an interesting conversation, Dev. I'm going to be curious to see your feelings on it and if there's anything we need to do show-wise because of those feelings.
Ooh, that should be exciting. I mean, that's the thing. That's the reason why we're doing this villain season.
Yeah.
It was a lot of those movies where, like, just on first glance, it would be pretty difficult to justify their inclusion into the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I mean, at the end of the day, that's really the goal, right? Is to get six movies out of the way that, like, we kind of were sort of, we had our minds made up beforehand. And it's been fun to have our minds changed on some of them. But also it's been kind of nice to have, like, you know, Spanglish. I understand why people were upset about it.
Yes.
I get it.
Sometimes you don't want surprises, which is one of the beauties of an Adam Sandler movie when it's done well, is that sometimes you don't need surprises.
Sometimes it's that Christmas sweater, to borrow nomenclature from Siege and Sarawak. God, I love saying your name sometimes. This is one of those times.
Clearly got on too long.
So next episode, it's going to be funny people. I don't know where it is out there or anything like that, but that's the next episode that we're going to look at. And we'll see. We'll see if that one fits into the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I'm excited to check it out. Until that time, let's do something, right? Let's do something as the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, tantamount to Alice's Restaurant, Massacre, a movement. Let's get That's My Boy in the top 10 on Netflix before the end of March 2022, where it leaves Netflix.
You six say report folks, you got Shrek up there today. You could do it with this.
It's true. Shrek is up there.
After all of our talk about B movie on that show, you motherfuckers went straight for DreamWorks. I know you people.
Yeah, that's what happens. So let's do it. If you throw on Netflix for your dog and you usually put on different stuff, throw on That's My Boy. If you got 2 hours to kill, throw on That's My Boy. Let's get That's My Boy. I'm not saying to number one. I will be happy with it at number 10. But before the end of this month, when That's My Boy leaves Netflix, let's the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe community get That's My Boy back into the top 10 on Netflix. I think we can do it.
Jeez.
It's an insane goal, right? But what are you going to do here? Hey, you want me to sleep with your wife? Yeah, I do that. Fuck. I'm sorry. I'm so happy I didn't do that voice as much as I thought I was going to do this episode. Thank you for a stimulating conversation about That's My Boy, Seijin.
Oh, my God.
And if you've enjoyed this stimulating conversation on a focus topic, Adam Sandler and his movies, you might like our less focused Anything Goes Wild and Crazy Podcaster Show, The Say Report, which a new episode is available every Monday. Just recently, we dropped an episode sort of like this, talking about Death Becomes Her for its 30th anniversary. So that should be fun. But also, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff. The world is changing, and a lot of exciting topics are going to be talked about on the Say Report. So if you like this, check us out there. You'll probably like that, too. If you would like to talk to Seijin about toxic buddy comedies, he can be found directly on Twitter and would love to hear from you at Siege versus the World.
And if you want to spam Devin with all of the gifts you can find about this movie, because it's one of the few things I knew about this movie going in, is that it had a rich gif well, apparently, you can hit him up at Devin D. Decker.
I look forward to ignoring your gifts. Until next time, thank you for listening, and remember, we have no idea what we're doing. See you next month. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you, and why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me, and we'll see you next time.